Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For more information about our upcoming shows or access to the more than 1,500 shows in our archives, visit www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Tamara Dean. She is author of Shelter and Storm, At Home in the Driftless. In 2004, Tamara Dean stepped away from the sterile hum of office life and moved to a farm in Wisconsin's Driftless area, a land marked by steep hills and deeply carved valleys laced with spring-fed streams. She was searching for a different way of being, to live lightly on the planet, to find grounding in the rituals of self-sufficiency, and to imagine a future that would be resilient in the face of climate upheavals. In her book, Shelter and Storm, At Home in the Driftless, Tamara shares 12 finely honed essays that weave together nature, history, and science, as she unravels the mysteries of a place that she came to call home. Shelter and Storm invites readers to step into the Driftless area's untamed beauty and meditate on how we tend the earth in times of uncertainty, what we owe our neighbors, and ways we thrive in a community. How do moments of ecological stewardship reveal the deeper threads of human connection? And how do we honor both the land that has shaped us for millennia and the lives of those who will inherit it from us? For more information, you can visit her website, which is tamaradean.media. That's tamaradean.media. Okay, with that, I'd like to welcome Tamara to the show. Good day, Tamara.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation. I just love people who promote grounded, being with the earth and stewardship. You know, it's something that we need to really be talking about a lot. So.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah. I hope this book serves as a conversation starter for a lot of people.
I'm sure it will. I will. So now, in 2004, you and your partner David, you know, did what a lot of people would dream of doing, you know, leaving office jobs and moving to a farm to live off the land. So how did you and David even come to discover and choose Wisconsin's Driftless?
Right. We had been living in Madison, and as you said in your introduction, we'd been living lives that a lot of people live. You know, most of the time we were in offices at computers, and we thought there must be a way to live with better health and closer to nature. So we went looking around for a place that we might start that life, and we found Wisconsin's Driftless area. Although it starts just a few miles west of Madison, I wasn't very familiar with it. It's about 8,500 square miles, mostly in southwestern Wisconsin, and it's called Driftless because it lacks the drift, or that's the geologist's term for all the silt and sand and pebbles and boulders that glaciers push ahead of them and then leave when they recede. Because the glaciers never reached this area out of just a strange confluence of coincidences, it has a completely different topography than the rest of the Midwest. So we were just seduced by its beauty. It's a magical, mystical landscape with, as you said, these steep limestone bluffs and these narrow river valleys. And it attracts a lot of people who want to go back to the land, so they say, and who want to try alternative kinds of lifestyles. But it has been a refuge for people for over 10,000 years. The indigenous Ho-Chunk people of Wisconsin have an oral tradition that tells them that their people were pushed into the Driftless area from what is now the Green Bay area when the glaciers, the last most recent glacier, came down. And so it has a lot of history. It also has unique flora and fauna. And if people can ever have the opportunity to visit, I highly recommend it because, as I said, it's just magically beautiful. So when we found that place, we thought, this is it. This is where we'd like to try our, you know, living close to nature.
Wow. Yeah, and I had never heard of it, heard of the area until I saw it in your book. And it's just, it's fascinating how there's so much around us. Like you were saying, you were nearby, but really didn't know much about it. It's just interesting how, you know, often, you know, we don't know the history or the, you know, the geology of areas around us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's true. You know, there's a highway, well, I-90 goes right through the Driftless area. And I'm not sure how many people who are zooming between Madison and La Crosse or Madison and Minneapolis know that they're crossing through this amazingly unique area.
Wow. So now you kind of have this plan, you know, the idea of moving, you know, from one very distinct environment to a very different environment. So how did your actual, you know, how did the reality of moving to rural Wisconsin compare with your initial version?
Yes, well, I had some romantic notions. I mean, since I was a teen, I had been reading narratives from people who had gone back to the land. So I imagined, you know, it'll be beautiful and wonderful. And it was all that. We also had the aspirations to build our own home from eco-friendly materials, to grow our own food, to, you know, create some of our own energy as much as we could, and to experiment in those ways. And, you know, being outside, we thought, would also keep us healthy. It's a lot of hard labor, and it's also fresh air, fresh water. And so those romantic notions were confronted with reality. Certainly, we encountered a lot of awe and wonder. It seemed as if all I had to do was step out my front door and I would witness something amazing and astonishing, whether that's, you know, a turtle digging her nest right next to our front walkway, or one day we saw raccoons swinging from the tops of an old oak tree, you know, scarfing down acorns. And I also discovered a rare blue glowing firefly that lives only in that area. But on the other hand, as the title implies, there was shelter, which is comfort and refuge, but there were also storms, threats and difficulty, and those included floods and a fire and a tornado and illness and all kinds of things that put to rest that romantic notion of going back to the land.
Yeah. And when I was reading about the blue light fireflies, it also indicated that you had to kind of really get prepared and kind of lather down against ticks, which is, you know, can be very deadly.
Yes. Ticks they became the bane of my existence there. The area that we lived in was known as the Midwest's epicenter for Lyme disease. And it was true. I had at least 3 critical cases of Lyme disease. The most recent one lasted almost 5 years. And that's, you know, daily not being able to count on having any energy to do what you would normally do. It was so frustrating. And I imagine that it's like what people describe long COVID as being. But nevertheless, you know, I sort of trudged forward, and I was so fascinated by these blue glowing fireflies that even though I was a little bit leery of ticks at the time, I wanted so badly to see them. So I went out to this marsh that was not too far from our house. And as you said, suited up and lathered up with the insecticide, and I did see them. It was just awesome.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed the reading about you capturing one with a cheesecloth at the top, and kind of studying it, but then ultimately going out and making sure it, you know, got out and was free to roam and breed and live its short life.
Yeah, exactly. And they do have such short lives. during the mating season. When we see them, they're flashing, they're trying to attract a mate, but normally they spend a lot of their time underground in different forms. And for that reason, these rare blue glowing fireflies that only live in that little piece of the driftless area are not going to be able to adapt to the changes in climate that we're seeing as the weather warms. You know, they can't move quickly. They can't migrate to a different climate. So even as the ticks are thriving, some of these other insects will be threatened.
Yeah, wow. Now, your essays in this collection are rooted in the land, but come alive with the interaction between the natural world and your personal curiosity around history and science. So tell us about how that intersection kind of played out in the writing of these essays.
Yeah, I'm just inordinately curious, I think. So as I mentioned before, it seemed as if all I had to do was step out my front door and something wondrous would strike me. And then that would raise a question that would lead me to research and to exploring. So I might research at the Historical Society, or I would call up experts like Lynn Faust. I called about the slow blue fireflies, or at the Historical Society, I found records about the people who were buried in the cemetery on our property. So I just, you know, some people might call it going down a rabbit hole, but I was so curious. I wanted to find out everything I could. And then it seemed the best way to synthesize all that I had learned was to, you know, encapsulate it in one of these essays. And, you know, humans are natural storytellers. We tell stories to make sense of our world. So I wanted to tell these stories to make sense of what I had learned. And I was originally a fiction writer long, long ago, and I still am. But when we moved to the Driftless area and all these dramatic things happened, I thought, well, this is more exciting than any fictional plot line. And so I turned to essays to, you know, hold that meaning. And I hope that the essays do act as little mystery stories. They begin with a question or a mystery or a quest, and then they pursue that. They might wind through different alleys of knowledge, whether that's nature or history or other kinds of science. And in the end, I hope that the tension is escalating and the meaning is deepening, just as it would in a fictional story, so that the ending has resonance and brings you to a place that you might not have expected when you started reading the essay.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, that format, I think, is a wonderful way to stimulate the reader to explore questions they may have. I mean, many times, you know, they may have a question, but it's like, okay, you know, it just kind of in and out of the mind, but with, you know, examples that you provide of actually going through and researching and uncovering mysteries and coming to certain conclusions, even some surprising conclusions, I think might be a way for someone who thought, well, you know, I would have just thought about that. I had that question, but maybe I should look at that a little bit closer now.
Yeah, and I hope that's what Shelter and Storm prompts readers to do, to look around them with an open mind and an open heart and some curiosity, because these mysteries are all around us. You know, even in a suburb or a city, there's something unexplained about nature that you can investigate. And, you know, we don't even know the basic facts about field mice. You know, I sometimes think, why are we going to Mars when we haven't fully explored our own planet?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I hope it inspires readers to recognize that nature is all around us and we can learn from it and be curious.
Yeah, I love being with nature. To me, that's my zen moment, is when I can be out in my nature. So
yeah.
Now, in this particular area, there have been weather events that kind of impacted the area and may have their roots in climate change. So tell us a little bit about, you know, some of these disasters that you experienced and what your feeling is about maybe the cause or the, you know, the reasoning why they're happening.
Yeah, we lived on a small spring-fed river called the West Fork of the Kickapoo River, and it was always known to be flashy and prone to flooding. But while we lived there, we endured 7 record-breaking floods, plus a lot of minor floods. But these were, you know, every year it seemed for a while there would be another record-breaking flood. And the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, which is a state-run organization that studies these things, has predicted heavier and more frequent rain events for that southwestern part of Wisconsin. So we were seeing the effects of that. The most recent flood we lived through was in August of 2018, and they called it a 1,000-year flood. You know, it just blew through records. It also destroyed the dams upstream from where we lived. So there was, you know, the morning after all the rain came overnight, there were 13 inches overnight north of us upstream. And the sheriff was evacuating everyone up to our house, basically. And we wondered if we would have to leave. But, you know, I looked out and I just heard a roar and our field, which was basically a quarter mile deep, was full of water and, you know, debris floating and tumbling downstream. It's pretty scary that although we were fine, we were marooned, but we were fine. People lost livestock and buildings, and thankfully no one happened to die in that flood. But, you know, a 1,000-year flood is no longer a 1,000-year flood. I think that's more likely to happen in the near future than it used to be.
Yeah. Now, these events, as I said, you know, are 100-year, 1,000-year, are happening just so frequently that it just seems to lose its impact, I think, sometimes with the fact that we're seeing them so often and referring them, you know, as such, that, you know, I think there may be a new definition, kind of what some of these, you know, the length of what some of these events are happening.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know how useful those shorthands references are. But I don't know if you read the essay Floodways from my book, but the last flood in 2018 prompted my friends from the Driftless Writing Center and I to initiate an ambitious storytelling project. We knew that there was research behind the power of telling our stories to heal from our trauma. In other words, people can recast themselves and recognize how strong and empowered they were to survive something like that catastrophic flood. So we went out and interviewed over 100 flood survivors, and they shared their stories with us, and it was so powerful. We brought them together at an event where they could share with each other also. We recorded their stories, and we gleaned excerpts from them, both for a publication, but also to pass on to lawmakers. The policymakers and municipal planners could use these insights from storytellers to improve flood resilience in the communities in the future. And that's actually happening now.
Wow, that's wonderful. You know, that's and you know, it would be beautiful for other areas to be able to learn from your experience and also, you know, do it in their local areas. You know, kind of do a ground up kind of change.
Yeah, I think that, well, we initially had hoped to create sort of a kit or a replicable model for this project that other communities could draw on. All the information is out there, but we didn't end up taking that final step. But still, it shows the power of, you know, this qualitative information to affect these practical solutions. So yes, I think it's very important to listen to people who have survived these tragedies and to learn from them.
Yeah, very much. So, you know, is that the the experience with community involvement, you know, that you had. Was there any other kind of activities, or, you know, what, in your opinion, you know, what are the benefits of, you know, being actively involved in community activities?
We learned so much about community living in a rural area where our nearest neighbor was a half mile away. First of all, everybody comes to help when you need help. For instance, our prairie was on fire. The fire went out of control, and the neighbors who had helped us with the controlled burn earlier in the day, I called them to say, hey, can we have some of that equipment back? Ours has gotten out of control and we need to bring it back. And they said, well, we had other plans for this evening, but we're coming over to help you now. Mm. Also, when our cistern of rainwater, which was our only domestic water source, ran out mysteriously while we were on vacation, people just came and helped us out. A person with a giant sap truck took it to the fire station, filled it with water, and came to our house and filled our cistern. And nobody asked what our political views were or who we voted for. That just was never something that came up. So we learned about the power of neighborhoods, even though they were large out there in the country. But we also learned about community through that storytelling project and from being involved with nonprofits in the area, like the local radio station, mm-hmm. the writing center, a stewardship organization. There's really a strong connection or network of people out there. And that's something I've brought back with me to the next place I move to.
Yeah, wow. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that is often missing with, you know, urban areas where, you know, that sense of community, you know, selflessly, you know, gives to neighbors, regardless of, you know, their belief systems, you know, that it's simply right. Neighbor helping neighbor.
Right. And I think we can all become an example of that, because once you take the step, you know, other people are going to join you. So mm-hmm. introduce yourself to neighbors, you know, help them out when they're in need of it. Don't ask questions. It does happen too in suburbs and urban areas. Maybe mm-hmm. it's just not as dramatic as what we mm-hmm. experienced.
Yeah, it's true. Now, excuse me, one of your stories, you basically went through and were looking through your historical archives and learned about a woman named Nancy Ann Harris, who was buried on your property. She died nearly 150 years ago after complications from her 10th abortion. Wow. So tell us about, you know, just your experience of exploring the archives, and, you know, what was your sense when you came across Nancy's story?
Well, it astonished me. Again, this was one of the topics that just struck me. I had been hearing for years from my neighbors that there were Civil War soldiers buried in that little cemetery on our property, but mm-hmm. that their tombstones had washed downstream in the epic flood of 1978. So it took me a long time to actually research this, but I did go to the Historical Society, where no records are digital there. So mm-hmm. the assistant curator brought me a binder, and I looked at the list of people buried in my cemetery. I found no men, so there were no Civil War soldiers there, in fact. Mm. But there were the children whose tombstones we did know about, and then two women. And I named one aloud as I sat there, Nancy Ann Harris. The woman who was sitting next to me at the table said, she was doing genealogy, she said, oh, she's my husband's great-great-great-aunt. And I said,
wow.
How do you know that? Yeah, it was just, what a coincidence. She said, oh, and she died of her 10th abortion. And I said, how do you know that? She said, well, it's in the death record. And I said, why would they put that in the death record? And the assistant curator who was standing behind us said, well, it was a different time then. And that's all I needed to just go and you know, research that question or her statement. What did she mean by a different time? I didn't have the opportunity to ask her right then because There was yet another woman who was overhearing our conversation, and she said, "That Nancy must have been something else." And I thought, you know, I thought it was kind of disparaging. I wasn't really sure what she meant by that, but we all became quiet after that. And then I did investigate Nancy Ann Harris's life. There isn't much about her. Yeah, I did see her death record in the Register of Deeds office. And indeed, you know, the notation about her 10th abortion is listed there, which is a strange thing. No other death records had something like that. And then I saw that her husband was a Civil War soldier, but after her death, he moved on to farther west. And I tried to imagine her life with her stepchildren and her children living in a tiny cabin right down the road from where my place was. You know, how did she manage her health and well-being and her fertility? Because at that time, 1876, women were more apt, especially rural women, were apt to figure things out for themselves, whether that's an abortion because they could not afford more children, or, you know, managing pregnancy or the complications of pregnancy. They would have relied on each other. For instance, older women up the road, you know, who could have counseled them, or sisters or mothers or aunts or cousins, whatever. But they surely would have seen women close to them die in childbirth. So it was kind of a birth control method. You know, abortion had none of the stigma that it does today. And it was also, you know, a way to be safe, because childbirth was very dangerous in those days.
Wow. I mean, that's some story. And you know, it's interesting, you know, as you were describing it, you know, with the one that overheard the name and kind of made a somewhat disparaging kind of comment. It's interesting how people, you know, hold certain opinions and beliefs and aren't open to recognizing nuance, like, you know, the time that that happened, you know, what was life like then, you know, and you know, what were maybe some of Nancy's, you know, challenges, I mean, for a tense, you know, I mean, that's a lot, that putting a body through.
That's exactly right. I had hoped that the essay would be an answer to that woman who had been eavesdropping and made that disparaging remark. I thought, let's have some empathy for Nancy Ann Harris. Mm-hmm. And also, let's bring the value and valor away from those fictitious Civil War veterans who were actually not in the cemetery, and bring it back to women who endured tremendous hardships.
Yeah, very much so. Now, one other essay that you had that I kind of enjoyed reading about was the one of how you engineered a beaver-friendly waterway at the request of a dying neighbor. I mean, you know, that has there's so much there. You know, the idea of a dying neighbor's request, you know, a beaver-friendly waterway. I mean, that had to have been quite a learning experience.
It was a big undertaking. And of course, if you read the essay, you don't, or we didn't know that the neighbor was dying. All we knew was that he was angry because we had allowed beavers to rebuild dams on our property. There was a little creek. And because they had built the dams, the water had backed up and flooded part of his low-lying field that was adjacent to our field. And so he was angry because he couldn't plant there. And he had never seen him lose his temper. It seemed so out of character, but we thought, okay, we will take care of this because we want to be good neighbors. And that's the title of the essay, Good Neighbors. We had previously actually trapped beavers at his request many years before, and we thought we can't do that again, partly because it was a little heartbreaking to find them, but it also because it didn't help that waterway was perfect beaver habitat. So As soon as we trapped a family, new beavers moved right back in. But we heard of this solution called a beaver deceiver, or sometimes it's called a caster master, that prevents the beavers from hearing the water flowing. Basically, it creates a tube under the water that just keeps draining the pond, but they can't hear it. And because they can't hear it, they're not prompted to rebuild their dams and And we thought, my partner David thought he could do this on his own, and he did. It was a giant engineering project in the marsh there in the creek, and it worked. And it was constantly draining the pond or the creek, and the beavers didn't know, so they didn't keep building it up. And when David went to our neighbor's barn to tell him we've solved the problem, the neighbor just didn't seem interested at all. And shortly after that, we learned that he was dying. And he, when he came to our door and, you know, had a fit about the beavers, it was really an expression of you know, him facing the end of his life and the end of a way of life. And I think in hindsight, maybe we could have been more attuned to, you know, the human struggle, even as we were attending to the ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, if you didn't know, I mean, it's hard, you know, to, you know, have that understanding, you know, and, you know, many times, I mean, it's hard to determine what the source of one's anger might be, you know, whether it be just their nature or simply, you know, that they're facing, you know, an end of life or an end of livelihood kind of situation. So, taking the eco-friendly approach, problem solving that you did, I think was a wonderful solution, even if, you know, he, you know, didn't fully understand, you know, the, you know, the, what you had to go through to do that. My sense is that, he's probably looking down from somewhere, kind of giving a smile, smiling that that you did that, and that you were really caring for him. So that was a wonderful thing.
Thanks. That's good to hear.
Yeah. So you come from a background with in IT and technical writing, and so, you know, nature, landscape, sustainability, all of those things are very different. Very different area is a very different area. So, what did you do? You feel that your IT and technical, you know, writing, how did that maybe prepare you for this new chapter?
Oh, what a great question. I think that working in IT and while I had written textbooks on computer networking and telecommunications for many years, all that taught me great patience with details. Sometimes that patience was very helpful when constructing our house, for example, out of mud bricks that we made from our own subsoil, or really working in the garden, which required a lot of detail-oriented, repetitive activity. I would say that's part of it, and also analyzing what came our way, whether that was a problem with construction or a situation with the landscape. Planning was also part of it when we conducted the prairie restoration. We turned an old hayfield into a prairie. There were a lot of steps involved, so it was a mini project plan, similar to what I used to do in the IT world.
Well, good. You know, and the one thing that I've noticed is that even though our journey may take twists and turns, and sometimes they're dramatic twists and turns, that each step along the way that there is a purpose for that particular chapter, and it is often used to build upon what comes next.
Yes, and I've certainly had a winding path. I mean, sometimes I talk with college students, and I always say it's okay if you don't know what you want to do now, because it will become clear, you know, follow your enthusiasm, follow the energy, and you'll find your right path.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I know for me, example, you know, I had very many, I had my degree in psychology, never went and did mm-hmm. anything, went into, you know, banking, became a, you know, a trainer in banking and a trainer in restaurants and, you know, and entrepreneur. So, I mean, that's, all of those things were never in my plan. You know, if, I mean, people said, do your 5-year plan or your 10-year plan. They wouldn't have been there.
Yeah. Yeah. That just proves, you know, how helpful it is to be ready for whatever new comes along.
Yeah, yeah, and to be flexible. I mean, because you know, certain opportunities you may not have had any idea, but you know, you may discover that not only are you drawn to them, but you maybe have a skill or a natural talent that can be you know applied. So, now one last item I want to kind of explore with you is that I understand that you built a house from earthen blocks. Mm-hmm. That sounds very early Western kind of activity. Tell us about that.
Well, David and I had been looking for a way to construct our home so that the home would be healthy for us and also for the earth. And, you know, long after we're gone, hopefully, it could just basically compost back into the soil. Mm. We had tried building an outbuilding or a wood shop with straw bales. We did build that. And it turned out that the climate of the valley was just too humid to make that reasonable for our house, we thought. So we knew a guy who had a ram press that made compressed earth blocks out of part clay, which we were able to get from our subsoil, and part sand, which we were able to get free for the hauling from the Army Corps of Engineers, which is constantly dredging the Mississippi River for shipping lanes. And the Mississippi River was about 35 or 40 miles west of where we were. So we had clay and sand and just a little bit of Portland cement to help those bricks cure. We made over 7,200 of those bricks with this ram press, and we let them cure a while. And then we built our home from a double wall of these mud bricks. And then in between, there was a gap of about 6 inches into which we poured perlite insulation. So the walls were about 19 inches thick, and they were super, you know, insulative, which meant that they kept the house warm in the winter with just one fire in the morning and one fire at night in our central fireplace, and they kept the house cool in the summer. It turned out to work very well as a house that didn't need a whole lot of energy, and it was beautiful as well and cozy. It was a lot of hard work, though, and I recognized that not everybody has the time to do this. You know, it was very labor intensive.
Yeah.
It's a construction technique that's been around for a long time. And if anybody's been to, you know, certain countries in Africa, you might recognize it there and in the southwestern U.S.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that's admirable, you know, to be able to, you know, to do that and also to be very aware, ecologically aware of, you know, its existence beyond you, you know.
Yeah, and I should say, to be completely honest, we had hoped to build a house without any plastic, but of course there are building codes, and we were required to use PVC plumbing in parts, and there were other required plastic parts, so it isn't entirely compostable, but it would get a long way there.
Yeah, as long as it, you know, passes inspection, so that you can live in there. Well, that's great. Well, I really enjoyed our conversation. Now, Tamara, I noticed on your website, in addition to, you know, excerpts from this book, you also have information about events, upcoming events. I believe there's a couple book signings in there. And then you also have workshops. So can you, would you mind just sharing with the listeners just a little bit, kind of a plug, so to speak, for those upcoming workshops?
Absolutely. I have a lot of events coming up. Some of them are book readings and signings. My book launch will occur on April 24th at the UW-Madison Arboretum in Madison, Wisconsin, in case anybody's around. They're welcome to come to that. And then I have readings in various places around the Midwest, from Mineral Point to Dubuque to La Crosse to St. Paul, Ann Arbor. All of that can be found under the events selection on my webpage, which is, again, is tamaradean.media, TamaraDean.media. And then, as you said, I have workshops too. I love teaching. You mentioned earlier, sometimes we just, you know, fall into things that it turns out we love and are pretty good at. And teaching is one of those for me. So I have workshops both online and in person that you can find under the workshops link on my website. One of them that I'm excited about is called Writing from a Changing Place, or Bearing Witness is what one place is calling it. So I teach these workshops with different writing centers. And it's basically about exploring what a place has meant to us and how it has changed and what it has left us with. And anyone can join, whether they're a poet or a nonfiction writer or a fiction writer, at any level. And I hope that they'll come out of it with the beginnings of a new piece. And I have lots of prompts and advice about writing that I share with people.
That's great. It's wonderful to share that knowledge and watch people thrive, you know, from that and be excited, you know, that's
yes. I was going to say, I think it's a myth that only certain people can be writers. You know, I don't think it's about being struck by the muse. I think it's really about putting in work day after day and following your energy and enthusiasms. Anyone can be a writer and can be a great writer with enough time and effort.
Absolutely. And everyone has a story to tell, whether it be their story or you know, something that they have thought about for a while.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things I love about teaching. I get to hear people's different stories, and they're just wonderful. You know, things that you wouldn't have imagined have happened to people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has truly been a delight, Tamara. I really want to thank you for your time. I've enjoyed our conversation.
I have too. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Tamara Dean, and we have been talking about her new book of essays called Shelter and Storm, At Home in the Driftless. And as she mentioned, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is tamaradean.media. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.